Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated.
Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart. You just heard from Ebony Johnson reading our intro, and Amy Bell is on the engineering board. And we will be talking today with Suzanne Rutter, a First Call, about how to cope with family issues during the holidays if you're living with an alcoholic or recovering alcoholic. And then what else are we doing? Yes, today we're going to begin a segment called Money Matters Minute. And we're going to give you tips weekly, we hope, about handling your finances. And then we'll hear from Ann Pritchett about every child. No child left behind. Not every child left behind. We've been leaving children behind for a long time, but hopefully we're going to stop that now. And Ann Pritchett will be joining us later. But now we're going to hear Ebony read Women's E-News from womensenews.org.
Headline news from Women's E-News. Daniel Holtzclaw, a former Oklahoma City police officer accused of raping women while on duty, was found guilty on December 10th, the New York Times reported. Holtzclaw was convicted on 18 of 36 counts of sexual assault and attacks on 13 women. The former police officer worked the night shift on the northeast side of the city. In the trial, prosecutors said that from December 2013 to June 2014, Holtzclaw targeted women he stopped while on patrol, signaling out poor black victims with criminal backgrounds whose stories would not be believed. The COP21 treaty draft on tackling climate change, which is being negotiated in its final stages at the global talks in Paris, does not include gender equality, Democracy Now! Reported December 10th. Women in poverty are disproportionately affected by climate change, according to the former Irish president, Mary Robinson, who said in an interview with Democracy Now!, "Who has to put food on the table? Who has to go further in drought for firewood?" Ashfaq Kalfan of Amnesty International says rights groups believe gender equality was dropped as a provision in the draft in a trade-off where some states agreed to drop gender equality, like the United States, in order to admit a reference to the rights of those living in occupied territories. Activists in Sierra Leone say the country's law legalizing abortion will save countless lives, Thomas Reuters Foundation reported December 10th. The Safe Abortion Act, passed Tuesday, replaces the West African nation's 1861 law that banned abortion except in cases where the mother's life was at risk. 1 in 70 women in Sierra Leone died in childbirth, and one-third of these maternal deaths are linked to complications from unsafe abortions. 11 Irish women who traveled to Britain for abortions are allowing their names and faces to be published online to highlight Ireland's near-total ban on abortions, The Guardian reported December 10th. The project coincides with Human Rights Day, where 12 pro-choice activists plan to protest outside the gates of Trinity College, Dublin, following the publication of the women's photos and stories. From 2013 to 2014, white men held 82.4% of directing jobs in Hollywood, finds a diversity study by the Directors Guild of America, Time reported December 9th. Women made up only 6.4% of the 376 directors of feature films released during that time period, and women of color made up only 1.3% of that same directing pool. Time magazine named German Chancellor Angela Merkel its Person of the Year, citing her leadership in this summer's Greek debt crisis and her encouragement of European countries to take in migrants and refugees, The Guardian reported December 9th. Merkel is the first woman to be awarded the title since 1986, and the fourth woman to ever be named Person of the Year since the contest opened to women in 1936. Rodhika Jones, the deputy manager editor of Time, wrote that the reason for this disparity is that Time's Person of the Year contest favor those with institutional power. I don't think a woman is going to be Pope anytime soon or talk over from Putin, but I doubt it will be another 30 years before the Person of the Year is a woman. It might only be one. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau officially launched an investigation into hundreds of cases of murdered and missing Aboriginal women on Tuesday, The Washington Post reported December 9th. Aboriginal women account for 16% of all female homicides in Canada, while they represent only 4.3% of the country's overall population. Blue Shield of California, a not-for-profit health plan with 4 million members, has adopted a comprehensive workplace domestic violence policy to protect its 6,800 employees, according to a December 8th press release. The Blue Shield Foundation is California's largest private funder of domestic violence services and prevention, and its new policy is adapted from a model designed by Legal Momentum, a women's rights nonprofit that has helped employers adopt formal workplace domestic violence policies. We Belong Together, a campaign led by immigrant women, will be walking in solidarity with groups across the country to denounce discrimination against immigrants, Muslims, and refugees, according to a December 8th press release by the National Domestic Workers Alliance. The marchers will take place December 11th in 9 cities, including San Francisco, Houston, Boston, Portland, and Miami. Earlier this week, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump suggested on ABC's Good Morning America to ban Muslims from entering the United States. During the Global Climate Change Conference taking place in Paris, UN Women, Us Flagging the Importance of Women as Environmental Activists and Managers of Natural Resources. In a press statement, the group is also providing a schedule of events for Tuesday, December 8th, which is being designated as Gender Day at COP21.
Thank you, Ebony. And now we have on the line with us Suzanne Rutter of First Call. She's a family services counselor, and we'll be talking with her today. She'll be giving us tips on how to deal with the holidays if one has a substance abuser in the family, that sometimes everything doesn't always go well, and the holidays are tough as it is. Right, Suzanne?
Yes, they are. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You're on the line here with Amy Bell, who just called you on the telephone, and Ebony Johnson, and of course I'm Sharon. I can't even remember. We did talk on the telephone. That's right, we did.
Yeah.
So what kind of tips do you have? You know, as I said to you, I lived with an alcoholic back in the late 70s, early 80s, and my sponsor in Al-Anon said always develop a plan B when there's a family get-together or an event. If anything can go wrong, it probably will. So have a backup plan.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there are tips a mile long. We had an hour and a half support group on how to cope with the holidays when you've got a loved one suffering from substance use disorder. So I could go on and on, but yeah, that's definitely a great tip. I think it's important to have a backup plan and to also be able to implement that backup plan, not to let yourself get caught up in feeling bad for the loved one who is abusing substances or feel intimidated by that person, but making your boundaries clear and setting them, and even saying beforehand, you know, if I feel like you're using substances or I feel like you're getting out of hand, I'm going to have to leave, and letting them know that up front so that it's easier when it actually happens.
That's easy for you to say, but when you're sometimes living with an abuser, there's an intimidation factor, and it's hard to overcome that. I told you about the, and I don't know, the time we went to the skating rink when he was supposed to be home and we were going to go to take my daughter to the skating rink, and he didn't get there, so we went anyway. So we get home, he's there, he's angry, and he raises a ball-peen hammer up over my head and starts coming down with it, and at the last instant hit the hood of my newly painted MGB. So I bring up a negative there. How do you deal with that if you're living with a physical abuser?
Well, physical abuse is a really tricky thing to deal with because of the issue that it brings. But definitely not being afraid to call the police if necessary, I think, is really important. If you feel like there's a physical threat, planning beforehand to have somebody else there with you and not putting yourself in a situation where you would be alone with the physical abuser.
Okay. So then what are some of the other tips you give people for planning holiday events around a family member who may or may not be fully present?
I definitely think that because this is such a difficult issue, a lot of family members struggle with trying to cope with having a substance user in the family, not just at the holidays, but just in everyday events, just being present every day, having that person really disrupting their lives. And so it takes some going out of your way. That's why Al-Anon is so important, and we have a program at First Call called How to Cope, and it's important to surround yourself with people who understand what you're going through so you can have that support, make those tough decisions, and you don't have to be alone in doing so. So definitely developing support over the holidays would be really important, whether it be with family or friends or people from Al-Anon who can help you set boundaries and hold strictly to those boundaries.
And we talk about Al-Anon, which has been an important tool for families, and Alateen for children of alcoholics. Those are wonderful groups for people to get attached with. How would one find an Al-Anon or Alateen group in their area?
Well, the internet's perfect for finding those. If you have access to the internet, if you Google Al-Anon in Kansas City, Missouri, for example, it'll take you to a website, or wherever you live, you can type it into a search engine, and it'll bring up what you need. Another possibility, is to call me, because I do work with families. That is my area of specialty. I work with families who have substance users in their family, and I'm happy to give out my phone number, and I can give you Al-Anon resources. I can give you resources to the family programs that First Call offers. So,
okay, do you want to go ahead and give your phone number now?
Okay, sure. It's 816-800-8048, and my name's Suzanne, so I'm happy to talk to anybody who's struggling.
And they can Google First Call.
Yep. Yeah, Google First Call, or go to firstcallkc.org/how-to-cope.
Okay.
And that's a great resource, too.
When we're talking about living with an alcoholic, are there ways to help that person want to stop, or do you have some tips that you give people on how do you help that person?
Well, the main thing to remember is that we have no control over that person. And until we realize that we have no control over the addict, we're going to continue to try and force the addict to change, which really almost has the opposite effect on the addict. They want to run away. And once we start to model healthy behavior, we model controlling ourselves and taking positive action in our lives and setting clear boundaries. That's when the substance user realizes that not only is their family member not going to put up with their behavior anymore, but they're going to change themselves instead, and they're not going to let themselves be walked all over anymore. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. Okay. I will tell you that it was so hard for me to learn that no one controls my feelings but myself, because I was absolutely certain that this person was just making my life miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so hard. What is that saying? How do they put that? But it's so hard to learn that. Am I repeating that right? I know it's a standard thing you have to keep telling people, is that person is not controlling you. You control you.
Right, right. We always, one saying that we have in our How to Cope group is, when I try to control what I can't control, I lose control of what I can control. So when we start trying to control things besides ourselves, which we can control, then we lose control of ourselves. We lose control of our mental health. We lose control of our social health, of our physical health. We see all these effects happening because we're putting all of our energy into changing this person who doesn't and is not willing to change for themselves.
This is Ebony. I love that quote or line that you just referenced. We've had conversations here about just growing into womanhood, and something that Sharon just referenced as well. Just, I think, feeling like you only own you, you know, and just knowing that I can't use my will to change another person, but I can use it to change myself. And ultimately, that is what I really want. Like you mentioned, having clear boundaries and taking different steps. I feel that's what we're really asking for. Like, I'd like to handle this situation differently for myself, even regardless to what that other person chooses to do.
Right. Yeah. And that all starts with seeking the right help. You know, so if we realize that we have this problem, we have a substance user in our family, and we're losing ourselves because we're trying to control that person, that's when we have to do what we've been trying to tell them to do the whole time. We keep telling them to seek help. Well, then we have to do that ourselves.
Yeah.
And so that means going to Al-Anon. It means calling and finding a therapist, whatever it may be, attending a support group. But we've got to get help for ourselves.
Do you have any advice for, you know, sometimes at this time of year, it's the extended family that's getting together, maybe the individuals in the family who aren't so intimately involved with the problem that's happening in this household. Is there anything that those people who maybe come to a Christmas dinner and witness something like this happening? Do you have any advice for that?
I guess kind of a follow-up question would be, are they already familiar with the situation, or is this like a complete surprise to them?
Probably more the surprise than the familiarity.
Okay. I guess, so if you're an extended family and you come in and you realize that there's this issue, don't be afraid to ask questions. It's an issue that has a lot of stigma attached to it. People, it's very taboo to talk about the disease of addiction because most people don't look at it as a disease, even though there's multiple studies that have been done. So if you're extended family, don't be afraid to ask if they need help, to ask if they need somebody to talk to help provide an intervention if necessary. Just be a support to the immediate family is the advice that I would have.
And oftentimes, the abusers are just marvelously people. They seem just people-oriented people, and everybody loves them. And I found that when I was trying to share with people my frustration and how I was being treated, I found no one really believed me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, it was so hurtful to me that people thought he was just wonderful, and I was the crazy one.
Yeah, that happens all the time. It really does, because if we think about the disease of addiction, the reason, the way they get that their drug of choice and get their alcohol is by lying. They have to lie to continue to get what they need. So they're very good at playing the victim. They're very good at showing, you know, keeping up appearances. So the family can often feel like they may be going crazy, but that's another reason that it's good to find support of people who do understand and have been through that, because you're not crazy. They probably do have some sort of a problem.
Yeah, that was very difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. It seems like with if you're dealing with a family member, that to remember that that compassion should include yourself. Because I think a lot of times that part of, you know, doing things to try and change that person, in which we know that only leads to our own frustration. But at the same time, knowing that the compassion that we want to give to that family member should include us, and that's where we can feel a bit left out. And do you think that a lot of people just do not think of, okay, maybe I need to actually go to a group, you know, to be supported by this? And, you know, because I would think, oh, well, why don't they go to a group? It's kind of like what you said, you need to go get the help that you want them to have. But, I mean, I would think, oh, well, I could just recommend them to some groups because they need this support, but not thinking for myself, well, I need the support, and how do I, like you said, how do I cope with this? Because it just, you know, it can be very frustrating, I think.
Yeah, it's part of the denial of the family. I mean, addicts are in denial too, but so is the family. They're in denial of what the real problem is, because what family views as the problem is the addict. So if they get better, then I'll get better, and I can't get better until they get better. And that's a common myth about the family and their recovery, is that the family can't recover unless the addict does. But it's not true at all. And I've seen so many families who go through our program and they recover, and they have an incredible life. And that doesn't necessarily mean that their loved one is sober.
Yeah. I heard this, I forget what it was, but I was reading an article, and this lady said, it was referring to like moving on, basically. And she said, if you will come, I will welcome you. But if you do not, I will move on with joy. And it really struck me, because I think sometimes we think we can't move on, or even we think we can't move on, but then sometimes we think if we do move on, it won't be with joy. And I feel like from just what you're saying, just, you know, that piece at the end there that you just mentioned, that there is hope. You actually can move on with joy, even if your family member says, I don't want to go with you. You know, wherever, if you're going down this path of, you know, you're changing you and you're learning how to cope better, and maybe I'm still in the state I want to be in. I think just knowing that you can actually move on and with joy is comforting to know.
Yeah, it is comforting. And I can tell you, there are so many families who, when they start, you know, we have a pre-test and a post-test, you know, just to see where the families are at before and after our program. Mm-hmm. And so many of them in the beginning, you know, will say, I can't imagine my life being okay if my loved one is still using substances. And by the end of the program, they have hope, and they'll come back to our alumni groups. We have alumni groups each month, and they'll come back, and each month they're getting stronger. Each month they're implementing the tools that we give them. And it's amazing to see, and it really does give hope to all the other families who've lost it.
That reminds me what you just said. My first Al-Anon meeting, the door was closed, and there was a crack under, it was in an old building on 63rd Street in Oak, and the door had a very high crack under it, maybe an inch. And I remember looking at that and thinking, I'll just slide under that door to get into this room. And I went into this room with all these women who were married to alcoholics, or I don't know if we're supposed to call them alcoholics or what. Well, you know, we're not supposed to label them, I guess. But they were in there, and they were laughing, and they were happy. And it had been so long long since I had laughed. I was just struck by it. How can these women be happy and laughing and smiling? It was amazing. And it was a great experience to me to find an Al-Anon group. So I do highly recommend that for people listening. And eventually you might find that the change in you will bring about a change in the other person.
Yeah, that's how it happens. Modeling behavior that we want to see in the other person is more effective than any kind of manipulation tactics or any kind of lectures we can give anybody. It's always about modeling.
Have you found that in your groups, people have realized that they may not have had the same type of addiction, whether it be in the form of alcohol or drugs, but they may have had another addictive type of behavior that the person they're trying to save brought up in them? If that makes sense, do you know?
Sure. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to make sure I was making sense.
Yeah, no, you made complete sense, and we find elevated substance use in family members, and I don't know necessarily. We don't go into a lot about their addictions, whether it be shopping or they all have numbing behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. Because when we're in an amount of pain, we want to numb it, and a lot of times that's overeating, sometimes it's shopping, sometimes it's exercising. So we see that, but we also see that the family will, say they had a husband who's drinking a lot, they'll try and drink more to try. Say he buys a case of beer, mm-hmm. they'll drink a lot of it so that he doesn't drink as much of it, right? So mm-hmm. they're trying to save that person, and they're getting sicker themselves. So that's another part of this whole disease, family disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for being on with us today, and we should probably have a first call on more often, because do you have any statistics about how many substance abusers there are out there in the world?
I don't. I'm sure I could find it, but not off the top of my head, I don't.
I think it's a lot more prevalent than we realize, and I'm sure a lot of people deal with it. Have you got any other things you'd like to share with us? And again, give us your website and your phone number again.
Sure. I guess the last piece of advice is make sure over the holidays that you're not biting off more than you can chew. Remember to say no when you want to say no, and ask for help if you need it. I could go on and on about advice for the holidays because they're tough. But thanks, everybody, for listening, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on.
Thank you.
And did you want me to share my phone number and
please.
Everything? Okay.
Yes.
So, again, my name is Suzanne, and I'm a family services counselor at First Call. And my phone number is 816-800-8048. And our website is firstcallkc.org.
Thanks again, Suzanne.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we have some messages, Amy?
Yes, we do. We'll be back shortly.
KKFI Holiday Auction is December the 12th at Ollie's Local, 31st and Gillum Road, 6 to 10 p.m. with live and silent auctions, raffles, and live entertainment from Jessica Page, The Match Sellers, Ivory Black, and Loaded Goat. Auction packages include a weekend at Table Rock Late, nights at the Aladdin Hotel or the Hotel Phillips, shows in Branson, the Steel Drivers at Folly Theater, shows at the Riot Room, and vinyl packages. KKFI's Holiday Auction is December the 12th, Ollie's Local, 31st and Gillum, 6 to 10 p.m.
When you were a kid and got hurt, you'd go to your mother.
For TLC.
Someone to stand up for you.
Same goes now if you're hurt by a drunk driving crash. Just go to the Mothers.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
MAD for short. Call 877-MAD-HELP.
Help and no charge, of course.
Of course.
Learn more about how we help victims of drunk driving next time you visit at MAD.org.
This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
We're going to start a new, hopefully a weekly little segment that we're going to call Money Matters Minute. And because money is so important, especially to women, and women need more of it for various reasons, which we can go into our healthcare
well,
needs.
Well, you also have a really wonderful phrase that I hear you say quite a bit about a man not being a...
a man is not a financial plan. And I have done many workshops about that, and it's so true that women need to learn to be responsible for their own financial futures. And so these tips, though, will be good for men and women. Today we're going to talk about credit card basics. More than two-thirds of people who have credit cards do not pay their credit cards off each month, and that can be costly in the long run. So what you should do is reduce your debt as soon as you can, and it's been recommended, well, we'll cover that another time. No, let me go ahead and say it. I hope I can stop myself. If you have not looked at your credit card report lately, you need to do that at least annually, and it is, you can go to annual credit card report and get a free download of all your credit cards from the three credit unions. You get to do that once a year. Free. You need to do that. If you have more than two cards, three cards that have zero balances on them, write and close those cards because they're actually a negative. The more cards you have that you can spend on, the lower your credit score will be. But ways to reduce credit card debt is to pay off the credit card with the highest debt first. That is, put the most money toward that card that has the highest interest rate on it. And pay your credit card bill as soon as you get it, especially if you have balances, because that'll reduce your interest rate charges. Also, if you can't pay the full amount, well, I already said that, pay as much as you can and look for low rate and no annual fee credit cards. You can go on the website and look at www.indexcreditcards.com and look for credit card list. And pay off or look for credit cards with no interest rate. You can transfer balances to zero rate interest cards, but be sure you make those payments on time because they can bump that interest up and it can cost you more in the long run if you don't make those credit card payments on time. Also, for people with debt problems, Consumer Credit Counseling, the National Foundation for Consumer Credit, is at 800-388-2227. And the website is www.nfcc.org. Lots of information there for student debt, reverse mortgages, bankruptcy, credit card counseling for those people who are in over their heads. And the source for this information is www.wiser.heinz, as in the ketchup, .org. And look for credit card information on that website.
All right, we're going to make this a weekly thing. I think that,
and we'll try not to make it too boring. That's the problem with money. What it gets boring and people's eyes glaze over.
Though I personally like to have a better relationship with money. Just one from a sense of not taking it too seriously, but not to, you know, just having a better balance of just how I view it in my own relationship to it. So I think, I don't know. I think it was funny to say, a man is not a financial plan. That's a good one to lighten it up.
Yeah. And, we should develop more healthy relationship with money and not be so afraid of it. And now our next guest is Ann Pritchett, who is a regular. In fact, she's associate co-host of Every Woman.
You got a promotion?
Well, I think you've been that for quite some time, but she's also a... But tell the people what you do for a living and for activist.
I'm a special ed teacher, and I am an active member of the teachers union in Kansas City, Missouri. And I'm also chair, or I should say co-chair, of the Kansas Progressive Caucus. Sorry.
And we invited you on today because something has happened with the No Child Left Behind bill.
It went away.
Well, tell us about
it. It's gone. They did away with No Child Left Behind and have replaced it with a bill that they're calling the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA. So ESSA, I guess. I don't know. They haven't really come up with a cute little nickname yet. Obama just signed it on Thursday. I think it was Wednesday or Thursday.
Just from the sentences of those two things, No Child Left Behind and Every Child Succeeds, they really don't sound very different.
Well, they're really good at the little catchphrases. We'll give them that. But when it comes to substance, I don't know.
Hmm. Have we had time to look at this bill yet?
I have, but it's 1,000 pages long, which I gather, or we've been told, that's short for federal legislation. And they did kind of throw it together quickly, so that raises a few red flags right there. Overall, what I know so far is that it's better than No Child Left Behind. However, there's still a lot of problems. And then also, philosophically, there's still a lot of discussion, I should say, in the education community as to how much control and power we want the federal government to have over our schools. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the tough call right now.
And this is Ebony. In what ways do you think it's better?
In what ways is it better? There's no more race to the top, no more of the silly little grant programs that aren't promoted, that were more like carnival events than real school reform. However, and then also one thing that's better is that they've given a lot of control back to the states. And the thrust of public education in this country is one of the founding principles of it is local control. And so there was a lot of contacts of Congress from both sides of the aisle who wanted more local control. I think more teachers would support more local control too.
Well, does that open it up to where we're going to have another embarrassing episode where Kansas stops teaching evolution and biology?
You know, that is the example. I sit on these national groups and I bring that up every time. I'm like, whoa, you guys, wait a minute. I live in Kansas. We need to teach evolution. And that is the fine line. And then also we really need the Office of Civil Rights. A lot of people don't realize, I guess, that the Office of Civil Rights functions in the U.S. Department of Education. It's a whole other branch, and that's part of the bigger Office of Civil Rights. But we need those people enforcing our federal legislation, guaranteeing a right to a free and appropriate education for every child in the country, regardless of race, creed, et cetera, et cetera. So we need some federal oversight. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened with No Child Left Behind was the feds just got in a little bit too deep. Because it's really, really tough to have standards that apply in all 50 states.
Yeah.
And across all communities. That just doesn't work. And I think we found that out through No Child Left Behind. So thank goodness that they did away with that. One disappointment, though, is that several groups had worked on getting an amendment, and Senator John Tester did write an amendment. Unfortunately, it was dropped out of the final version, but it would have returned us to grade span testing. And grade span testing is where it's like it was when Sharon and I were in school. You test like in third grade or fourth grade, and then again in like eighth or ninth grade. Two or three times through their 13-year school career, they take tests, versus now it's grades 3 through 8, and then once again in high school. And we worked really, really hard. The testing has just got completely out of control, and it's governing what we do in the classroom with your children every day, and that just needs to stop.
I feel like I tested like every other year or once
you
every
might
three
have,
years
you might have.
Or something like that.
But this
and,
is every
And I
year.
Have to admit, I love those little fill-in-the-bubble tests.
Well, yeah. Well, they're not like that anymore, honey. They're not.
Oh,
it's all online. And then it's
online?
Not just that, yeah, all of them now. It's not just that one test that we report to the feds. It's everything that leads up to that, because the culture of the school now has become oriented towards test scores and student achievement. Now, I'm not saying I'm against student achievement, you know. Heaven forbid I wouldn't speak out against that. But that's taking up 99% of our time.
Yeah.
And one thing, as a longtime teacher myself, I want to see the kids. I'm an elementary teacher, and elementary school is supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And we don't have as much fun as we used to because we're so focused on
the next test. Like right now, where I work, we're prepping for the big test that we take in January that is just a predictor of the main test, which is in April. Because, you know, you practice, and then take a practice test, and then you take a predictor test that tells the school district how you will probably score on the real test. I mean, it's just out of control. Mm-hmm. And all the data that goes into that, you know, because we have to, and they call it data, you know, we have to submit and do little quick tests with the kids. Like one thing I have to do is have every kid read to me for a minute and count how many words they read in a minute. And they want me to do that once a week. I'm at every other week now, but that's it sounds like, you know, it's just a minute, but when you do it with each kid one at a time, it's pretty time consuming. And I don't know how much good that data is doing me. All it tells me is that Susie could read 5 words a minute in September, and now she's up to 15. I mean, you know, so. Yeah.
And that's what, just your point, that's what I thought, even with talking about the money, just that going to school should be a fun, interactive experience. Well, I'd like it to be a fun, interactive experience, and one more to help children and the teachers kind of explore more and not so focused on right and wrong answers.
Right. It's more rigid.
Yeah. Yeah.
They use this word that I don't know if many people outside of education know this, but it usually, the big key word now is rigor. And they'll come in and evaluate our lesson, and they always find, and then they watch us teach, and then they sit down and talk to us afterwards. And one thing, and by they, I mean our administrators, they always mention rigor. And the catchphrase is that there's always a way to increase the rigor of that lesson. A good example of increasing rigor is instead of giving them a test of 5 items, you give them a test with 10. Or, you know, it's pumping it up. One of my principals used to say, let's pump it up, ladies, let's pump it up.
Yeah.
And, that really takes away from the climate of enjoying school. My school this year, for the first time in a really long time, we did more for Halloween than because that had gotten into where between the testing and then the objections from certain community groups, Halloween was almost non-existent. Well, it's kind of slowly coming back. We had a parade this year. We let the kids wear costumes. The teachers handed out, we did like a trunk or treat where they just walked from place to place, and the teachers handed out the candy while the parents walked the kids around in the community. It was wonderful.
My nephew's school did it the last
and it's been a long time since we've done that. And the thing is that no matter how old you are, when you look back to your elementary school experiences, you don't remember taking those tests, but you remember the Halloween party. I remember this year, for me, when I was in the third grade, my teacher was Mrs. Keeling, and we had, I think, one black and white TV on a cart in the whole school. And back then, baseball games were all on during the day. This was in the 60s. And she promised us as a reward one morning that if we, you know, all got our work done or something, that we could watch the World Series game in class that afternoon. And so through that World Series run, in whatever year that was, we got to watch all of those games.
Nice.
So, and when I remember third grade, I remember watching the World Series.
Yeah.
I don't remember what I learned in math.
Yeah.
I don't remember learning writing or whatever, but I remember watching the World Series.
I remember watching the O.J. Simpson trial.
At school?
Yeah, I was a sixth grader.
I think that's very inappropriate.
I'm sorry. It was very memorable. We watched really mostly just the verdict portion of it. But it is probably age inappropriate, but at the same time, it was such a monumental part of the 90s.
It was.
That I'm really grateful to have been given that experience a little bit too. And like you said, I think when you have really rigid structures, then the teachers don't have the ability to say, okay, this class can handle watching something kind of more adult content, or you know what I'm saying.
And all of that is, like, as I said, related to the testing. So, and let's review real quickly, if I have a minute here. With No Child Left Behind, the goal originally, and that law took effect in 2002, I believe, the goal was for 100% of our children to be proficient in every academic area. Well, then they bickered over how to define proficiency, and they allowed all 50 states to define it differently. So you could be proficient in Missouri, but maybe you're not proficient in Maryland. Yeah. Or a proficiency score in Hawaii might not cut the mustard in California. So that in itself is kind of ridiculous. But then when you really think about that, if you've ever taken statistics or basic psychology, it's impossible for 100% of a group, of any group, to be proficient at one thing. That just doesn't happen. Life is a bell curve. Our human population is a bell curve. We have some people down on the lower left, some on the other side, all the way to the right. But then most of us are right in the middle on that big hump, you know, that gives the bell curve its name. And in order to and what these writers of No Child Left Behind actually thought we could do was take that whole curb and move it over to the 100 mark at the end on the far right side, which is just crazy. You don't really need to know much about psychometrics to know that that's just doesn't make any sense. So we had to fight that politically for a long time. And I think we finally got that message across. And there's not as much rigorous proficiency standards in the new bill. But we still have to test the kids every year and report that those test results to the federal government.
Well, one thing that in this, they seem to be trying to flatten that bell curve.
Right, which
really maybe helps those people that are down at the bottom. But
well, it's impossible. See, it just can't. I'm not a psychometrician. It's humanly impossible for everybody to be perfect.
But just
one
logically,
thing.
It also takes away
or at everything.
The people that are up on the higher end.
It takes away
the individuality.
Imagine if
your
rainbow was just one color.
Yeah.
You know, it takes away all the other stripes. And one of the nice things about humanity is our diversity. And that even gets down to learning and capability in terms of school performance. And that's what makes a nice classroom climate. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, you might be terrible at math, but genuinely a virtuoso in music or art or
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the arts because you're a piano teacher, and you know that what's happened to the other core subject areas in our school, in our public schools in America, they've gone away. You know, we no longer have instrumental music programs in my district, and a lot of school districts are doing away with that. Only reading and math is required to be tested every year. So what's happened is that's all we teach. And now in Missouri, we teach science, too, because the kids do take a science test in fifth grade. But social studies has just been thrown out the window. And we have an entire generation, I am not making this up, an entire generation, 15 years worth of children, who have not had a good social studies instruction. What does that say about preparing children to be functional adults in a democratic society? And why Donald Trump has the support he does. I mean,
even when they were teaching social studies seemed like, depending on how the states wanted to use it, slightly like a propaganda mechanism to how to train the children how to behave.
Right. And it was one of those touchy areas. And rather than tackle it, and there's so many things at the national level that the federal government could have done to make that better. But instead of doing that, they just basically threw it away.
Well, for example, you have people in my generation who went off to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan having never... I was in the Shawnee Mission School District, having never read more than a paragraph's worth of information on Vietnam.
Wow, I don't teach high school, I hear things all the time about high school curriculum. I go, what?
And, you know, I think a lot of people who did know what happened with Vietnam were a lot more questioning about what was happening in Iraq. They very conveniently made sure that the entire generation that was going to grow up to fight wars now didn't have the information about that.
You know, and I don't know that anybody sat down and orchestrated that, because I honestly believe that the real focus behind all of this is an overall desire by what we can now call the ruling class in America, which is the far right wing of the country, to prove to us that government doesn't work. And the way they do that is by breaking it. And of course, public schools are part of that government system. And since I started teaching in 1980, and since then, in fact, since before then when I was getting my bachelor's degree, there have been unwarranted and just outright false attacks on public education. They've been trying to convince us, and Diane Ravitch goes back 50 years. She says for 50 years, they've been trying to convince us the public schools are failing, but they're not. All the major statistics, college entrance scores have gone up, high school graduation scores have gone up, and dropout rates have gone down at a national level. And I'm going back to the beginning of public education in America. We've done a better job over and over and over for over 200 years now at educating our kids. That data is there and it's real. But instead of paying attention to that, you know, you can focus in on any little thing and decide that it's a problem. And that's kind of what we've been dealing with. It's very frustrating.
Do you feel like more parents, or there will be more homeschooling?
Yeah, well, it's on
my
the increase
says she
now.
Thinks that it's just going to go it's all the way to homeschooling.
Now, that's one reason a lot of us who are strong public school advocates, such as myself, hesitate, and for years we didn't speak out because we didn't want to give parents a reason to pull their kids away from the school system, because a vibrant, diverse public school system is a really important part of democracy in the country that we have here. And so it seems like those of us working in the system are the only ones who are still trying to keep it going. So I hate to encourage people. What I would rather see is for those parents, because the parents who have enough desire to homeschool and the resources to do it, because that means mom probably doesn't have a job, yeah, or dad or somebody, there's an adult, mm-hmm, there. Those are the kinds of people we need involved in our public schools. Those are the ones who should come and get involved in their PTA and their parent groups and at the district level around for school board.
Well, what about the lack of oversight in homeschooling? I've been hearing more and more about this. And honestly, I have known homeschoolers who were using the term school very loosely.
Let me explain the law.
11-year-old kids that didn't know how to read.
Let me explain the law. I'm not as familiar with the law in Kansas, but I've told that it's less rigid than the one in Missouri. I work in Missouri, so I know the Missouri law. The homeschooling legislation, all it says is that the family must notify the local public school. And that's just a numbers thing, so they don't have to count the child in their enrollment. Mm-hmm. And they have to keep a log, or like a diary, of what they do from day to day in their homeschool. Now, here's the catch. The only person who has any authority to see that log is the local prosecuting attorney. And in the 25 years now that law has been on the books in the state of Missouri, there has never been one case where a local prosecuting attorney has asked to see that log. So basically, there are no regulations.
I know of an instance where a couple of young girls are being homeschooled. And I'm sure their mother is very well-intentioned, but the problem, as I see it, is they have not introduced computers, and one of them is 11 years old and knows nothing about a computer.
And in your public school, they're on all day now, so it's such a contrast.
I know.
And I don't mean to denigrate homeschooling. You and I both have a very good friend whose children were homeschooled, and they're bright kids. They're adults now, and I know many families like that. But my concern is, like with this story that's been in the news here about the little boy out in western Kansas City, Kansas, it's just too easy to hide and to bring your children up less than adequately.
Well, I have friends that were homeschooled that are just, it did wonders for them. It was amazing.
Yes.
But what I don't understand is the argument that we're going to regulate every single kid in this state, in this country, except for this handful of kids that we're just going to let completely slip through the cracks. That if your kid would be tested and evaluated any other place,
they need to take the test. I've said that all along. Let them do what they want at home. Because I don't like the idea of education Gestapo knocking on these families' door to check what they're doing with their children. I wouldn't want them doing that at my house for any purpose, homeschool or whatever. So I don't want to start that. But if they would just hold them accountable to the same standards that the public school children are held accountable, then we'd have good data. And if they're really doing as well as they say they're doing, then they shouldn't mind being tested.
Well, yeah, and what gets me in that situation is that a lot of conversations had about the parents' rights. We talk a lot about the parents' rights, and I'm wondering, what about the children's rights here?
I have that conversation all the time.
You should have, as a child, you don't know. You're entrusting your life, and I think every child should have a right to be a functioning adult when they make it to adulthood.
Exactly.
I think that should be like a bill of rights for children. That they be prepared.
Yes, I agree. So, anyway, all in all, like I said, I think the law is better. It's given a lot of power back to the states, which would be bad news to those of us who live in Kansas, and bad news to those of us who live in Missouri, too, because of our state legislatures. But in other states, it'll mean better things for those children. So, and I have to support local control. I mean, it's like I said, that's if you look at the big picture, that's where we need to be.
Well, will local control be local, or will local control be in Jeff City and Topeka?
More in Jeff City than more has been returned at the state. It's, at least is my understanding. There's more that's been returned at the state level than the local level.
Would it be better if we did see more actual local control?
Maybe. I don't know. Because like I said, think about it. Think about some of the school districts. If they could run with it, you know, there'd be no evolution. There'd be all kinds of discriminatory practices within the district. So
how are we with having diverse schools right now?
I think it depends on where you live. How are we with having diverse communities? If you have a diverse community, you have diverse schools.
Yeah.
Schools just reflect the community. We don't really have a lot of control over that. Is it more diverse than it was when I was a child? Yes, much more so. Is it as diverse as it should be? I don't think so.
Yeah. I think it's tough, too, with even as we just talked about the testing. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about culturally how tests are constructed and, mm-hmm. you know, how questions are asked. And, you know, one child may read it a certain way. And
exactly.
You know, so some of that is tough, I think, as well, when we say, well, let's do all of this testing, and then someone thinks, well, the tests are culturally biased. And
they really, and they're better than they used to be, mm-hmm. but there's so many examples. Just recently, my kids were taking a test, and it was about tennis. And I'm like, mm-hmm. none of the kids at my school play tennis.
Yeah.
And with tennis terms and the vocabulary, of course, there's that rigor element, so they had to insert several much more difficult vocabulary words in the reading passage. But yeah, there's definitely a cultural bias.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ann Pritchett, sharing your experience with the education process in Missouri primarily and nationally.
Yeah. And make sure that you stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf. Got Representative Brandon Ellington coming in to talk about the 2016 legislative session.